Blog Talk Radio.
Spataro is coming on to talk Bolin's Pythons, the International Collective Arboreal Symposium, Chondros, Rough Scales. You got your Morelia fix for the week. And speaking of Morelia...
On the right day, actually. You know, it's not Thursday. It is Tuesday.
Yes. Malfunctions. Well, we did almost have a slight malfunction.
Shut up. Nothing happened.
So the show is brought to you by MoreliaPythons.com, the best Morelia carpet forum on the net. So go over there, check it out. I know you got some news to unload on us, Owen, so go for it.
I have massive news, and that would be that I just got a bunch of eggs on the ground, and that would be my caramel Venus has dropped her eggs. And she was put my caramel male. Got that button. Goddamn button. Anyway, she was put to my caramel male Mars, so it's super caramels on the way. And final count is she had 25 eggs.
25 eggs. No 15 egg clutches going over on at Rogue.
Not over here. Not time for that bullshit.
The secret is, I don't want to really tell anybody this, but I guess I'm going to have to divulge that Owen really lives next to a nuclear power plant. And
yeah, I dip them in and for when they're babies. Yeah. So,
I have.
But you and I were talking about the next clutch, which is. Is the IJ, the Granite IJs, they're the next ones up. And then after that, my carpet Sophie is due. And that's the interesting one.
That girl's going to deliver my season. So.
Well, last time, see, she didn't breed last year, but the year before, she had 52. And... I'm looking at her, and she's massive. And I'm like, dear Lord, stop it. No. So I mean, like, I'm probably going to put something on the website of over, under. Are we going to break 60 or not? I don't know. So, yeah, you're right. One snake delivers the season.
Wow.
So,
and what was she bred to again?
She bred to my red jag talon. So
okay.
Big freaking clutch of tiger, a big freaking clutch of jags coming out. So
cool. All right. Yeah, it looks like everybody's getting clutches on the ground. So it's carpet season has officially started. Johnny Blaze Jungles on the ground.
Oh, those are gorgeous animals. And I told,
they're not even out
I told,
of the egg yet. What do you see?
I know, but the
gel
parents are. Shut up. I'm talking about the parents. The parents are gorgeous. And I told Chris Bayoff that I would quickly sell my Arian Jays so that I could buy prettier animals and buy one from him. So.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah. In case you don't know what we're talking about, Chris Bayoff of CB Reptiles, his famous jungle, Johnny Blaze, and I believe he was bred with Lemon.
Lemon. So.
Maybe we have to be a little French or something like that.
I don't know. I don't know. I really don't. But
they pretty much look together. I think the female.
That fucking picture to them is ridiculous. It's like,
yeah.
I don't. It's just pretty.
Imagine that sitting on your table at a reptile show.
Yeah, if I had the two of them in a container at the reptile show, I'd be selling. It would be constantly, no, it's not for sale. No, it's not for sale. Go away. I mean, that's usually what you do when you got pretty animals on the table.
You send them away.
If they're ones that you're displaying and not trying to sell it.
For the love of God.
I mean, like, I brought Talon with me to that 3-day Redding show, and someone comes up and they're like, I'll give you $500 for it. I'm like, go away. Go away now. Quickly. So, it's. Sometimes you got to field that crap.
Right. I wanted to give a shout out to what's his? I'm just total blank now because I don't have my paper.
Oh,
me.
Out. Oh
yeah.
Crap.
The VPI. I don't know if you saw that post that I put over there, but apparently their second book. Actually, they have two books coming out. They have. What is it? A Guide to the Identification of Pythons in Indonesia, Philippines, Papua New Guinea, and Asia. And they're looking for pictures of some different type of... I know there were scrubs on there, chondros, white lips, right up your alley. So you should go over there and check it out. I put it over on the Facebook
awesome.
Page. And they're also looking for... I don't know if they're looking for the... pictures so much of the blood pythons as much as the I think they have like clutch data and stuff that they're doing like they did in
awesome.
The first book so
cool.
I'm sorry I'm just over on my little tablet. Did you see it?
No, I don't want to talk about it. I'm about to ruin him in a minute. Continue.
Nothing.
Once
special.
I find the right picture,
I'm sorry, I got distracted because.
No, you don't. Nope.
On
stop
her,
it.
I guess it was Morelia Pick of the Week, or maybe it was just David Kelly posted up.
Yeah, it's on my face. I killed some people.
Grow some.
This is why I should never have accepted friend requests from snake people.
Yep. They just love you so much. But,
yeah, I
yep.
know. Well,
there's
did you see what I put on Jason Balin? I'm sorry. Go ahead, and then I'll tell you what I put on Jason Balin.
Yeah, that's just an example of an IJ doing what they do best, maternal incubation. And that is actually one of the parents of one of my IJs.
My mm-hmm. goodness.
How about that? So, go ahead.
How
what did you
about put? That? Continue. Oh,
no,
what I put
ahead.
On Jason Balin? I put Venus's eggs in the incubator and took a picture of my sticker that I have on my incubator, the messing with my campering with my eggs will result in an ass whooping you will never believe, won't forget.
Oh yeah,
and posted that on his Facebook because he kept posting pictures of his tiger doing maternal incubation on mine. So I'm just gonna post every single clutch I get in the incubator on his. Might as well if we're gonna do this, we're gonna do it right.
Yeah, you gotta
so,
do it right. Man. Do it.
Now
all
I gotta
way.
Find a picture. To post on Kelly's, and this might ruin him. Continue speaking. I swear to God, I'm listening.
Yeah, I think I'm going to go with maternal incubation.
Of course you are. There was no doubt about this. I mean, why are we even talking?
Yeah, well, I was kind of on the fence. What is going to do? What is going to do it?
Well, here's my thing. Would you come off of it? If say this was like a very very expensive clutch, would you trust her, or would you be reluctant?
Well. I got if I'm going to be honest, when I was first looking at my citrus tiger pairing. I was kind of like, eh, is she going to do it? Is she not? Should I leave her do the maternal? Should I not? Going back and forth. But, eh, what the hell. I'm going to go for it. I'm just going to do it. You know?
Maternal incubation. All right.
Yeah, I'm going to try it. I mean, I'm going to have the incubator going just in case, you know, just in case.
Oh, good. Okay.
Because, you know, I don't want to.
I've already said, I will leave you outside of my front porch because of all the crap you put me through. You can be holding your eggs incubating yourself.
Yeah, I'm going to have to call out of work for about 3 months. I'm sorry, I can't leave. I'm taking care of these eggs. Yeah, I think I'm going to do that. I think I'm only getting 3 clutches this year. What? Did I miss something?
I hate that man so much.
Uh-oh.
Jason Palin just texted me, and of course, I feel my phone vibrate. I pull away from my head to look at it, and it just says, "You big girl."
Nice. So much love, you, Owen.
Well,
so
the
love.
Problem is that I believe, and this is probably true, that what I'm doing is I'm probably just poking the hornet's nest with a stick, and this is all going to just get so much worse.
You're going to pay. You know it.
I really need to get my ego in check and calm down before this just turns into horrible. So, I'm just going to be quiet now and accept my...
We've ruined you, McIntyre. We've ruined you.
Not yet. Just put those damn eggs in your bed real quick. Anyway.
Yeah, I put up the three girls that I think are going to go. I think my girls that were, you know, head albinos, caramel head albino, zebra head albino, I just think that they weren't old enough.
Right.
I think they were big enough. I just don't think they were old enough. So I think that matters. And, you know, I'm glad they'll go next year and we'll be off to the races. So
good.
I'm glad I got a rodent breeder now that I can go to at any time. So, you know, I just tell her what I need, hooks me up, and, you know, I think that I'm going to approach feeding a bit different for this season. I was very sparse on the feeding, but looking at different things, I think that I should have been more aggressive a little bit earlier if I was going to do like a seasonal breeding type of thing. I mean, seasonal feeding type of thing. So, I don't know. Just my thoughts. So, you live and you learn. You, on the other hand, you just feed. So, you never have to.
I do not just feed. I do not, because that's how you go broke. So, we have slimmed down with the feeding. It's just I feed big meals at the time. And, of course, I just have these monsters. And, unfortunately, I can't let this one go. Take that, David Kelly. Anyway, we're just going to ignore whatever it is I'm doing over here. I posted a picture of Sophie laying her last clutch, and I said, can't do MI. The clutches are just far too big. 17, that's adorable. So I just kind of am poking the IJ people and all the MIs at one point, and I will now turn off my Facebook and hide. Anyway, I just feed larger meals, and it's just I definitely feed when they're younger, and then I kind of slow it down when they get older, and I just have these bigger snakes. I don't know why. I mean, and it's not even like they're that much bigger. I have one of Jason Balin's males over here on a breeding loan, and he's not that much bigger than my boys, or not that much smaller than my boys. So, I don't know. Of course, the boys aren't the ones that matter. So.
Yep, it's the girls. Yep, you're definitely right. So, I know that I'm pretty excited this Thursday. We're just waiting for Mark to call in.
Cool.
I think he's calling in the wrong number.
Oh, crap.
He's calling in my... Get Owen. Run with it for a second while I take this.
Is that what that noise is? That is a terrible ringtone. We're going to have a discussion later. Anyway, hopefully I don't incur the wrath of too many of my fellow... Morelia keepers. It's all in good fun, and I promise I will take it in stride. Please don't be mad at me. Anyway, hopefully everybody else is having a very good season. You guys getting eggs. I'm not sure if anybody's still seeing locks at this time. Anybody have any late clutches out there or getting locks or still kind of dancing around some animals? Post them up on Morelia Pick of the Week. I definitely want to see that.
Okay. Yeah, Mark should be calling in a minute.
You got the wrong
number.
Have you been getting any locks, or are we done with that kind of stuff?
Still getting locks? No.
Yeah. Well, you remember I had that one clutch that was laid in July. So technically it would have been breeding now.
I haven't seen any locks, but I still have my zebra jag with Minx, Julie's Jungle. I know that Julie said that that jungle went late before, so we'll see. But I haven't seen any seen anything from him. But I guess without further ado, let's get Mark on here and get this ball rolling. So, hey Mark, welcome back to the show. Glad to have you.
Thanks for having me back.
No problem.
Awesome.
So, how you guys been doing?
We're doing okay. We're just kind of poking around and,
he never has his notes ready, so he got taken.
Shut up. I had them right in front of me. They were minimized, all right? Now they're up. Jesus Christ. Didn't do anything right. Anyway, Mark, why don't you just start up and tell us about the ICAS and what made you start it with Buddy and Barry? Because, to be honest, Eric and I are extremely excited about it. I can't wait.
Yeah, for good reason. I mean, I think it's something that all of us as a group are ready to participate in and experience. And, you know, I have two different professions. In my professions, I go to different symposiums, and I've been doing this for over 20 years. And it's always been something that I wanted to orchestrate and put together and bring everybody together, but do it differently. You know, we've all been to reptile shows, and I'm sure there's a lot of the listeners out there that have been to different symposiums and hopefully like the IHS and things like that. And, you know, me coming from a zoo field, you know, I got to experience the tag meetings, IHS, and things that are involved as a professional zookeeper. So I just, I just got to thinking that, you know, we, all of us in some way or at some level are scientists, and we all emphasize herpetology, and we all devote a huge part of our lives to reptiles and amphibians. So, you know, it makes us scientists as a collective group, and we spend a huge amount of energy into keeping these animals and preserving the species and making sure that they reproduce. And none of this would be at all possible if it wasn't for professional, you know, field biologists and zookeepers and animal trade business. And I just got thinking about the whole scope of things and just thought, you know, we got to get back to our roots, and we really got to appreciate the people that literally, you know, dedicate their lives to being field biologists, because I started there. You know, my first degree in environmental science was in herpetology, and, you know, I became a field biologist, and then I went into the zoo field. And, you know, these are people that have such a passion and such a dedication to what they do that, you know, they sacrifice a other jobs where they could make more money or have a better lifestyle, and it's truly devotion, and you got to respect that. And I really wanted to give them a stage that they could come and present to us, and you know, where we could all appreciate what they do and appreciate what they've given us, the knowledge they've given us from a natural history standpoint, so that we can have the ability to work with these animals in captivity and follow our passions. So, you know, I sort of bridge the gap because I do both. You know, I still do field research, and I still maintain animals at home and as a hobbyist. And so seeing that reflection, I just thought it would be neat to have a symposium where we're presented by scientists to share the information, and at the same time we have a vendor show. And we combine the two, but we, you know, Barry and Buddy and I have been brainstorming, and we're going to put a lot of twists to this event. And I think that this is going to, you know, hopefully change the way some of these events are handled. Not that they're handled wrong, just putting a different spin on it and making it both educational and entertaining at the same time.
Okay. So what really makes this different from your average reptile event? Just the fact that we have like an actual science, almost like a scientific meeting going on just a little bit away?
Yeah, well, I mean, along with the lecturers, obviously, and as we all know, so let's just clarify, you know, yeah, it's called the International Collective Arboreal Symposium, and, you know, I think a lot of people, as soon as they hear the word arboreal, they think of our typical species that we talk about, chondros and Amazon trees and emeralds, but the reality of it all, you know, the majority of the snake species out there are arboreal. You know, I've never seen a boa constrictor in a wild that wasn't in a tree. I have black rats around my house that are always in the trees. I've seen timberback rattlesnakes up in trees. So, you know, there's a huge amount of species that utilize an arboreal nature. So it's a broad scope or a broad title for a symposium. And I think the thing that's going to make it different is the quality of speakers. You know, we've hand-selected a lot of different subject matter, from, you know, PhD scientists at universities to veterinarians to up-and-coming field biologists like Daniel Natush, who's out there in the field in New Guinea where I go. So we're offering high-quality speakers that have a lot of field experience and a lot of time under their belts to share their knowledge with us. So that's the science side of it for sure. Different that the vendor show doesn't start till later in the day on Saturday. So you have this scientific symposium going on the day where you're being educated, and then the symposium starts later that night. And the symposium is not only a vendor show, but it's what we do as a group when we get together. It's a party. So
yeah, good.
You know, that's why we normally get together is to have fun, you know, talk about reptiles, see our friends from around the country instead of just, you know, having this computer connection to them. And at the same time, you know, there's going to be vendors there selling animals. But on top of the vendors, you know, the little twists and things that we have, you know, we're going to have raffles and silent auctions and giveaways. In order to get high-quality animals there, we're going to have a corporate sponsor like Best of Show Award. And, you know, I think when people
awesome.
Think Best of Show, they might think of, you know, a little bit of cheesiness like dog shows. But if you want to see animals that you've never seen before, you know, a lot of people haven't seen rough scales live or some of the other morphs of chondros or, you know, emeralds, etc.
Don't bring rough scales. I'm just going to be grueling at them the entire time, and that's just not good.
Well, they'll be there for sure.
Damn it.
So, you know, if it's up to me, we're going to have just about, you know,
everything
type of arboreal species represented, Sanzinia,
awesome.
Annulates, you know, black emeralds. We're doing our best right now to try to pull a group of people together to bring the extreme of the extreme out, and that's the Best of Show Award, and we're hoping with these corporate sponsors where there's cash prizes, you know, it'll entice people to do so.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and, you know, that's what I want to see. You know, when I go to the show, I'm tired of going to reptile shows, and no offense, ball python people, but, you know, I'm tired of seeing ball pythons, leopard catchers, et cetera. You know, I want to go there. I want to see a badass scrub. I want to see bullins. You know, I want to see things that I don't get to see every day. And, you know, back in the day, that's why I used to go to Daytona and Orlando because, you know, the wild-caught animals that were down there, you go down there and you get to see some really cool, unique stuff that you've never gotten to see. And
that is true.
And I think that's where the shows have gone. And we're not going to have wild-caught stuff here, but there's plenty of really cool stuff in captivity that, you know, people protect or you know, keep at home, and we're hoping to entice them to bring a few of those oddities and rare things out. And I think we have the ability to do it in this area. So
we'll try to bring our Waminas just to show them off for a little bit. I'll talk to Chris. But
exactly.
Yeah, that would be
so,
that sounds awesome. So was it, like, really hard to get this together, or was it more of, like, a labor of love so it didn't really matter how
yeah,
hard
I mean,
it could have been?
You know, surprisingly, and when we started all collaborating, you know, it definitely takes a teamwork. You one person couldn't do it by themselves for sure. But once we got the ball rolling, you know, and it's great about the community, and it's a great thing about the internet is you're able to access people halfway around the world and, you know, talk to people. And once I found that we had a good foundation of speakers that we could build on, and really that's that was my main emphasis personally, was the speaker side of it. Like, you know, I want this to be a science-based symposium because, like, again, like I already expressed, I believe that we all are scientists at some level. So I think that we all should experience and hear what these people have to say. And so once we had that established, and the whole vendor thing was just more or less reaching out to people like Rico and Herpetologic and, you know, all the people that we know in the area and saying, look, these are our ideas. This is what we want to do. Would you guys be interested in? You know, again, we all share the same passion. Who wouldn't be interested in it? So once we started finding out who was on board, it just kind of escalated and grew. And, you know, Buddy and Barry and I continue to have meetings and talk to people and discuss it. And, you know, we're trying to, right now we're just trying to portray or express, you know, why a lot of the questions have been based around pricing, for example. And I don't know how many people out there, I'm sure there's a lot, but to give you an example, my other profession as a strength coach, when I go away to a symposium, an average weekend symposium for me will cost upwards of $2,000 to $3,000. So when I look, and I've been to different symposiums for different professions. So when I look at our costs, you know, the fact that you're paying $100 for a weekend to get quality speakers, access to a vending show, it's really, in the grand scope of things, I feel that it's fairly cheap. And I just can't imagine anyone not wanting to participate in something like that. And I think the problem is, you know, most people are used to just going to reptile shows where the entrance fee might be $15 or $20, and I think they're just sort of relating it to be just another reptile show, which I can guarantee anyone that's listening, this will not be just another reptile show.
Wow.
So it continues to build. I mean, you get a free meal with this from a high quality restaurant in the area, ribs or crab cake. I mean, when have you ever gone to a show?
Yeah.
I mean, there's usually vendors there that have, you know, fries and chicken fingers that were
burnt chicken fingers and
right. You know, we're talking about quality meal. You know, this place has a full bar, swimming pool, everything.
Whoa, backtrack. Full bar? What was that?
Full bar, yeah. Eric, this,
can you run the
atrium
table without me?
Yeah, in the atrium where the lectures are going to be held, there's full bar.
Oh, my God.
This is
terrible.
and then this place is accessible many different ways. If you fly in, you can hop in the light rail and come right up. You never have to worry about driving a car or anything. We're offering international travel, meaning if you fly in internationally, we will arrange to pick you up and bring you to the hotel. And we do have quite a few international people coming, which is great.
Mark, was there a question about the hotel, since the event is actually in the hotel? Is there like a block rate on the rooms or something like that?
We just went through the first 50 rooms. They only allow us to block off 50 rooms at a time. So we just went through the first 50 rooms, and there is a discounted rate from the total price.
Okay.
And so when you call up, you're just basically, you know, saying that you're the dates and it's the Arboreal Symposium. They give you a code, and, you know, it basically relates to a discount. The hotel has 252 rooms. It's a fairly nice-sized hotel. And then there's adjacent hotels. Like, there's literally one that you could walk to in 2 minutes, and then they get a little further out. But there are adjacent hotels that are a little bit cheaper, like, you know, Red Roof Inns and things like that. But, you know, if you can come into the hotel and stay there, that would be obviously the smartest thing to do, considering it's a one-stop shop. So.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I think you're right, though, that people that's what I'm trying to get the word out there to people, that the show's going to be more than just walking around and looking at ball pythons and leopard geckos on a table. You know?
Well, I mean, you know, right now we're building, you know, we're going to have you guys doing coverage. We're planning on having live video of the whole event.
That's cool.
Yeah, we have different ways to promote vendors out in the lobby with PowerPoints on big screens. There's going to be highlights of which vendors are where, and there'll be interviews that we're going to try to set up with you guys with different vendors throughout the show.
I'm excited.
One thing we're working on is there's we're giving away 4 lifetime achievement awards. And so we're going to have some special guests there that will be announced as we get closer to the event. So, I mean, awesome. Like I said, this is a much different venue than, you know, just a reptile show. So this is recognizing people who have dedicated their lives to the profession and you know, like always, continue to share our information and hopefully keep building the hobby, because right now we're not getting much support in any other direction.
Yeah.
No, not really.
So, is there anything else? Let me think. I'm trying to think if I have any other. Do you have any other questions, Alan, about anything that you can think of?
Can it be August now? Like, can we get there like now?
Yeah.
Is that an option? Like, yeah, I'm so jazzed for this thing. It's ridiculous, and definitely want to get going with this. It sounds like it's going to be a bit. It kind of sounded like it was going to be a mini Tinley at first, but now it sounds like it's something so much more now with the lectures and the fact that you guys are going above and beyond to highlight the vendors as well as whatever else you guys got going on there. It sounds like you guys put a whole lot of work into this.
Yeah, we continue to, and like I said, I just encourage anyone out there that has an interest, if you have a question, like, you know, if you don't think you can come because you don't have a place to stay or you can't afford a place to stay, anything like that, just shoot one of us an email and just see if we can help you. Like, just don't write the symposium off because, oh, you can only afford a ticket or you can't afford to get here. Just shoot us a message and let us just see how we can help out some way or figure out a way to help you. I mean, there's so many of us that live in this area. When I say so many of us, I mean, there has to be 30 or 40 reptile people in this small, you know, in this area that we're holding it, that, you know, it means crashing at somebody's house. You know, there's so many options. You know what I mean? If you like to camp, you can throw a tent up in my backyard. I mean, you need a car. I'm just saying, you know, we have options, so don't rule out anything as far as if you really want to enjoy this event or experience this event, you know, shoot us an email, let us know what's up. Send us a Facebook message. You know, we have the Facebook page, which seems to be the easiest way to communicate throughout the world right now. So,
awesome.
I said, don't write it off. We have 4 months from this, you know, it just started April 1st. So we basically are, the countdown's on for 4 months. So I just can't imagine there's anyone out there that can't figure it out in 4 months.
Yeah, right.
That is true, hopefully.
Yeah.
So.
Do you have a good number of vendors going to the show?
Yeah, you know, we basically the one main room we have holds 36 vendors, and then we have another room for flow over as it builds. The main room's filling up quickly, and it's, you know, mostly with people that all of us know right now, and all the names you'd see that you would think was coming. And as far as the chondro world and stuff like that, you got to remember the foundation of us having Chondro Fest here for so many years. There's a large foundation of chondro people, so, you know, majority of them are on board already, and then it continues to grow. So
that's awesome. Cool. I can't wait to see the all those different chondros in person, and oh man, I'm excited about it.
Well, I'm gonna be kidding, a candy school with the scrubs and things like that. It's gonna be great.
Yeah, I need to see a black emerald. Like, I, you know, I've seen a few, but, like, I'm dying to see another one real in person. And then I think Rico said he's going to help us out on that. We have a few other options, and we're trying to get Ed Marino over here with some of his crazy emeralds. So, you know, if we can – I just want to see some really badass emeralds. I haven't seen any in a while. I used to keep a huge collection of them, and I'm just kind of jonesing to see some big old dog-faced emeralds.
Yeah, I didn't even think of them. Duh. I mean, I guess I'm such a Python guy that I kind of write off boas, but emerald tree boas are beautiful. So, wow. That's going to be cool. Awesome stuff. I don't know. Is there anything else you wanted to hit on? You know, I want to give that as much play as possible.
Play,
I don't know if you had anything else, you know, that we're forgetting about that maybe you wanted to highlight.
No, I mean, I would encourage people to register because that helps us sort of orchestrate the event itself. So if you have any interest, at least register as soon as possible. That's just going to help us continue to grow the event because, you know, where there is a business side to this, meaning as people register, we know what we can do and how to grow the event. I mean, we have grandiose ideas of, you know, party tents outside and everything else, but that'll all be determined on how many people register. So, you know, I encourage registration, because the more people that register soon, the more we can build and grow this event. So,
awesome.
Really about it.
And I guess as far as my last question with this will be is judging by the success, which I'm sure you guys will be successful, you're looking to make this a yearly event, or?
Well, that's definitely the idea. I mean, especially, you know, when Buddy and I talked about this about a year ago, you know, we wanted to make it so that it is an annual event, and that we each year, you know, we go above and beyond with high quality speakers. I mean, I have some really cool reserve speakers, and I'll just throw one out there just because I find this interesting. I have a guy that's been researching flying snakes for 15 years, and he's been doing it with cinematography. So, I mean, to see the breakdown of snakes flying through the sky, flattening their bodies, and they're some of the most gorgeous snakes out there. I mean, they're rainbow colored. But, I mean, like, we have some really cool speakers that, you know, for years to come that we already have in backup. So, I mean, there's a lot of cool things that are going on out in the world right now. And you know, the world's become flat, so people are able to communicate and travel throughout the world easily. And to find these people isn't hard anymore. And, I mean, we have some, put it this way, if the events continue, the amount of information being shared and the experiences should just grow.
Awesome.
What's the website again, just so we get that in there so they know where to look this up
simple.
At?
Yeah, it's arboreal symposium.com. And then on Facebook, it's, you know, the International Collective Arboreal Symposium. I'm sure, you know, we're all friends on Facebook. If you go to Buddy, Barry, or I, we have posts up already. It's an easy link up if you guys aren't fans of it yet, or joining the group, I mean. Please join it, and you'll stay posted on what we're doing.
Awesome. Yeah, I also threw the link to both up on the Morelia Python Radio Facebook page, so you can link it up there as well. So,
thank you.
Good. Okay. Let's talk some Bolins. Your love. So first off, yeah, I want to congratulate you, man. I loved your article in Herp Nation. I waited patiently for that to come out. I thought you did a great job on that, and it was a huge accomplishment that you finally hatched out some of those guys. So, you know, what was the experience like?
Yeah, well, thanks so much for the compliments on the article and everything. I appreciate it. Well, the experience obviously was rewarding and satisfying. You know, I've dedicated a huge chunk of my life to the species, and both monetarily and physically and mentally. So to have that goal of, and my goal has never been just reproduction, but obviously we all keep snakes to reproduce and have the satisfaction of seeing those babies. So that was extremely rewarding. And, you know, the event, as I described in the article, was a little nerve-wracking, but, you know, to actually have hatchlings in my hands and to see them being raised right now, and, you know, I just feel like it was a payoff, like, you know, finally a little bit success to go with all the work and hours of dedication I've put into it. So rewarding is probably the best way to describe it.
Okay. What were some of the you know, you said you had some obstacles. What were some of the obstacles that you had hatching these guys out? I mean,
yeah, the biggest was really the female being snake. I mean, excuse me, the female being egg bound, and you know, she was first time female, and I keep my females small, and the eggs, as I described in the article, are just huge, and I'm sure people have seen my video. I've posted up online and on YouTube. If not, you know, it's easily to find. But, you know, to see that size egg that was coming out of her was just alarming at first. I was just like, wow, you know, you poor thing. So, but, you know, and I don't live extremely close to Dr. Stahl, and it's not that it's super far. It's just the congestion and the traffic, because you're battling D.C. traffic. And for those of you that have never driven around Washington, D.C., doesn't matter what time of day, but 495 Beltway is just a cluster. And so, you know, I it's taken me 6 hours sometimes to get home from Dr. Stahl's just because of the rush hour traffic. And wow. If it was a straight shot, no traffic, it should only take about an hour and 15 minutes. But so, you know, even with a snake that's egg-bound, you don't know if it's going to take you 2 hours to get there, 3 hours to get there, 4 hours to get there, and then you have this snake who's, you know, somewhat suffering from the eggs being bound or uncomfortable anyway, and just getting there. So that was the nerve-wracking part. It was just the, you know, the stress of knowing that there was actual live, viable eggs inside her that were stuck, and, you know, to get this far to finally where I have a grab at Boleyn's, and at the delay just not go, you know, sort of textbook, you know, where you come down the next morning and the female's wrapped around eggs. Instead, you come down and, you know, there's one egg here and one egg there and one being pushed out. You know, it's just that was where the stress began.
Oh, man. I can't even imagine.
Right.
No. Wow.
And then, you know, when, you know, in the article I describe, you know, how we get to the vets and we give her oxytocin, and then, you know, typically that gets them on their way, and, you know, 2 hours later, she's still not doing anything, and I knew that if I didn't leave, I was just going to have to spend the night there, which wasn't an option. And, you know, so then we hop in the truck and take off, and the next thing you know, this female is spitting out eggs in my truck driving up the beltway.
Oh, my
oh God.
You know.
Wow.
So, yeah.
I don't even know what I would do.
Right? You know, like that's...
There's nothing you can do, just drive home.
Right. So, it was quite the experience, but, you know, again, I ended up... several eggs in the incubator, and, you know, two hatched out like I described in an article, and they're both males, and they're, you know, they're passive little guys. They're not aggressive at all like most bull and I. I started off feeding them quail scented rat pups or rat pinks, and the only thing I can tell you that's been different, and I expressed this online a few places, and a few other people have expressed they've experienced the same thing, is, you know, these guys went from their brick red coloring to black in a matter of a few weeks. And
really?
I've never experienced that ever with bull and I. You know, all the farm hatch stuff that I've gotten my hands on over the years, you know, they've held on to that sort of juvenile coloration well up to about a meter, and these guys just went black. I mean, they're black and yellow right now, and they're, you know, they're small. So
weird.
Any thoughts on what's going on there?
No, I honestly have no idea. I've never really thought about it from a complex standpoint. It's just, you know, who knows? I don't have any answers. It's just what happened to them, you know, and after seeing a few people say that they've gotten some farm hatch stuff that has did the same thing, well, it's obviously not uncommon, so it happened.
Right, yeah.
That was my first experience, and I've kept a lot of bull and I over the years, so, and everything that's in my collection I've raised from hatchlings, so...
Red, black, I guess you'll take whatever, just as long as it's born at your place, right?
Right.
Yeah. So. Okay. So do you think that your female will go again this year? Are you breeding the same female again? Or?
Well, I'm definitely trying her again, and I have her and another female, one of my oldest females. Both of them have great follicular development right now. They're all doing the same things that they did last year. So my fingers are crossed. You know, I'm basically trying to replicate it. I waited it a month later this time just to give my female that did reproduce at least another month to rebound. And she gained her weight back quick and no issues, nothing like that. And so, you know, I'm hoping that I have two this year that have great development, and we're just, you know, basically seeing how the weeks go, and I'm hoping that, you know, this could be round two.
Wow, that'd be awesome. You said that in the article you were talking about how it was part luck on what happened. Do you think that with this season you'll be able to drill down more to why you had success?
Well, you know, I always believe in luck just with this species because for years I've been getting follicular development. And, you know, the biggest change was the female going off feed and really just staying in her nest box and never leaving it. So, you know, the lucky part came with her going the distance. Drilling it down, you know, really the biggest thing is every female act different, you know, with her. Once I noticed that she was staying in the high box, I just knew that she needed to maintain a good temperature to keep that development going. And so I just really paid close attention to the temperatures and just really tried to give her what she was looking for. And, you know, it meant coming home from work and checking on her during the day to see if she was coming out and basking or if she was staying in the box. And so I did a lot of running back and forth just to get an idea of what she was doing. So now that I had an idea of what she wanted, I'm able to replicate that this year, and then I applied it to this bigger female that's doing the same thing. So I'm hoping that, you know, my system works.
Okay.
The one thing about keeping snakes, and, you know, we discussed, you know, some of the things we're going to talk about tonight, but, you know, the one thing that I'll throw out there that will lead into another discussion in a little bit is the fact that everybody's home or the way they keep snakes is different. So, you know, what I'm doing downstairs in my bull and eye room might not necessarily work for you guys. You know, it's that's what people have to realize. You know, there's some people that they get their house or their room dialed in, and, you know, they breed snakes constantly. And I think that that's the one thing everyone has to consider. You know, they hear this method, that method, but they can only take that method into account and apply it to how their collection is maintained.
Right. Absolutely. Right. Learn to read the snakes, right? Instead of following a formula. Let's see. What else do I in the article, actually, I'm going to skip to this other question because I guess it runs better with – and I'll go back to the – question with the water. In your article, I noticed that you offered food straight through the breeding season, and you increased the frequency right before you begin to cool down. We've had a discussion on the show before about feeding cycles and how, you know, it can – we actually talked about it before the show began. Do you think that this is key in getting the female to take the follicles to the next stage?
I do. You know, if you look at – seasonal patterns in the wild, you know, there's always rainy seasons that basically spark life. You know, everything starts reproducing, and I think animals just know that, you know, there's going to be more prey out there, so if they're able to feed more and they know that more prey is coming, it's basically a signal to say, hey, you know, this is a good time to reproduce. And I just, you know, I've been in enough environments and have observed enough things to know that that's how Mother Nature works. So I think feed cycles are key, and because I'm not a power feeder or an overfeeder, you know, with my snakes, that's definitely a signal to them, because, you know, I maintain my snakes, and I've been preaching this for years. You guys are probably tired of hearing it, but, you know, my snakes are very long and slender and skinny, man. And, you know, people, I see all the crap that they put out there about things I say, the little remarks, but the fact is that's what they look like in the wild, and that's how they're supposed to look. So that's how I maintain them. And that feed cycle basically tells them that, hey, you know, there's an influx of food here. That must mean that there's more food to come, and it's reproduction time. And, you know, I've had a lot of success keeping and breeding my snakes that way. So that's what works for me.
Okay.
So I think that it is a thing that that people should consider.
Very good.
Awesome.
Now, also in that article, I noticed that you were talking about bolons and the need to drink more than any other species that you work with. And I know that this comes up too, especially with Moralia, the whole question of humidity. And I was wondering if you could give us your thoughts on the difference between humidity and hydration, because I think that people get them confused.
Yeah, I think they do as well, but I think both are a necessity. You know, I think fresh water is a necessity, obviously, and, you know, I don't know if we can express it as a need to drink, but for whatever reason, you know, bullens, pythons in general just drink a lot of water. I mean, I've worked with a lot of snake species, and I've never seen snakes drink like this, and it's fascinating to me. But so I'm very aware, and I'm always giving them fresh water because of that, because that's really the one medium in our environment, our captive environment, that can grow bacteria. So you have to always be aware of not to let it go too long, especially with an animal who likes to drink. As far as humidity and hydration, you know, I think both are important. You know, you have to look at the type of environment that your species lives in. And being in bull and eye habitat, I mean, there are times when there's extreme humidity, and there are times when it's extremely dry. And really, the environment is able to dry out quickly just because the substrate's so shallow on top of these limestone outcroppings. So it may torrential downpour, and then the sun comes out and bakes it, and it's dry in no time. So you have a, you know, fluctuation between humidity. So, you know, I think in the wild anyway, you know, they're able to drink a lot, and they're also exposed to a lot of humidity, but they're also allowed to dry out. So in captivity, I don't think there's anything wrong with providing humidity as long as it's a cycle, you know, where it becomes humid and there's a great deal of air circulation and the air doesn't lay stagnant, because you got to remember these animals are contained in a box where they can't move around a lot and they can't respire a lot. So, you know, their lungs and the snake themselves don't get the activity to get the bacteria, you know, flowing in and out of the lungs the way that it should. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
That's where humidity becomes a problem. It's the stagnant air and the immobility of the animal, you know. So I think that there's a good balance, and I try to provide that balance. You know, you can spray down a cage and let it dry out where they get a nice humid level for a while, and then it evaporates and everything dries out and it's fine. You know, so, you know, you hear all these conflictual opinions, but I really don't see, again, I think it always relates back to how you keep your animals. If it's a room that doesn't have good air circulation or you can't get fresh air in there, you might not want to keep the humidity up all the time.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense.
I'm a big advocate, and I know it's on my website. I mean, I run air purifiers. I've made it so that my airflow in my house, I'm able to turn on an exhaust fan and suck air from the outside in, and, you know, I can totally exchange all the air in my house in a matter of minutes, and it correlates into my snake rooms as well. There's vents in all my snake rooms, so I think fresh air is important for any living thing, especially something that's held captive in a box.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense.
So,
I do have a question. Hold on real quick.
Go ahead.
Aaron from iHerp, he sent me a message, and he wants to know, Mark, if you're going to be giving a Bolin's presentation at the symposium, because he saw your presentation in Daytona, and he wants more.
He wants more. Well, you know, I considered it, but I really wanted to just orchestrate the show with Buddy and Barry. Like, I didn't want to have to give a lecture at this particular one. And based on
Sure.
our timing right now, it's not possible. The only way it would be possible maybe is Sunday after the vendor show. If someone wanted me to give a presentation, I'd probably be willing to do it, but I'm not incorporating one into this show. I have thousands and thousands of slides that, you know, I like sharing with people and showing them the habitat and everything we found, and that includes other species of snakes, because, you know, we've seen scrubs and chondros and carpets, and so, you know, we've covered a broad spectrum of all the reptiles that we like. But
right.
This year, definitely not. You know, I got to go back to New Guinea last year, and I'm hoping to get back there again this year. So, you know, hopefully I can build on some new stuff so it's not quite as repetitive. Even though I can show pictures for hours, I just would like to be able to present some new data or some new information, or at least some new landscape anyway. So not this year, but
The future holds a possibility.
Future, definitely.
Awesome.
Like I said, you know, if there's a crowd of us hanging over on Sunday, you know, I know people are just hanging out somewhere, you know, we can always make it another Sunday evening, get together and throw some slides around anyway and just talk shop. I just don't want to give a formal lecture this year.
Okay.
Cool.
Sounds good. Good, Owen.
No, it's cool. I mean, at least bring some of the bullions. I would love to never actually seen one in person.
Yeah, no,
so,
definitely. We'll definitely have some bull and eye there. I can promise that.
That'll be the way to convince me that I need to have them at some point. So, which the other thing that people are dogging me about are chondros and how I don't have any, and I should I think it's Buddy who says that I should just sell all my carpets and fill my room with chondros. So that I'm also concerned about. But you've got a pretty nice collection of chondros down there, don't you?
Yeah, you know, they're another labor of love, and, you know, it's a love-hate relationship just because chondros are definitely one of the more sensitive Morelia, and, you know, they seem to have more issues than most Morelia, in my opinion, of all the ones that I've kept. You know, they drop dead on you for no reason. They get RI, and sure, you'll hear these, you'll hear these hypotheses or theories on ways to keep them where that doesn't happen, but I would just argue that, you know, they're chondros. I've been keeping them for over 20 years, and it's just they're more sensitive species. That's what it comes down to. And, but I do love them, and I put a huge amount of my time into them. And, you know, I definitely have some unique ones that I cherish and love. And you just, you know, it's one of those things where you have to be grounded mentally to keep them. I'm not sure.
Well, I'm out. So
yeah, right?
I don't need to do that. Cool. I have an excuse now.
Yeah, so, you know, the condor world is, and we've discussed this before, but the condor world is just really starting its birth as far as color morphs and, you know, the potential of what's out there. I mean, there's been, you know, a handful of unique animals here or there, but now these pairings are reproducing numbers and more people are getting their hands on them. And, you know, I did a great breeding this year as far as, well, I shouldn't word it like that, but one of my best breedings I've ever done in the condor world was my female Bruce with Andrew and Barry's Morpheus. And if you know condors, the dream bloodline stuff really produces some amazing things. And,
oh, yeah.
These hatchlings should be pretty phenomenal as they grow up.
Awesome. So, how do you keep your chondros? What's your approach?
My approach is pretty simplistic. I'm still using the 2x2 Neodichet arboreal cages. I've been using those since the early 90s and still continue to use them. Paper as substrate, a live pothos plant, different diameter perches, PVC throughout the cage, and I believe in daytime lighting, so I have a light cycle, and that's pretty much it. I still spray them down, and I don't keep them at a constant temperature, and I allow them to experience, I wouldn't call it extreme temperature fluctuations, but, you know, there's a 10-degree temperature difference between my day and night year-round.
Awesome.
And, you know, the thing about chondros, and especially after being in New Guinea, you know, all the habitats are highly variable, you know. And I think I've expressed this before, but, you know, I've been in the Cyclops where in the middle of the night it's still 90 degrees. And, you know, I've been in other highlands, you know, like the Star Mountains where it's 40 degrees and there's chondros there. So, you know, I think it really depends on the locality of the chondro, but long story short, they know how to maintain temperatures. I'm sure they seek places in nature that allow them to retain, you know, a viable temperature throughout the night when they experience the cold temperatures. Or in the other extreme, when it's really hot, they know ways to cool down. And so, you know, it's the power of Mother Nature. But in captivity, you know, they're limited to what we can provide them. And I really think the biggest problem with chondros is their inactivity. Because in the wild, you know, all the chondros I've found have come down out of the canopy and were on the ground hunting. So they get a lot of exercise, and, you know, it goes to what we were talking about with the air purification. And the fact is, you know, these animals have to be active to hunt. And in captivity, because of the perch they hold, you know, they have that draped coil around the perch, the respiration's shallow. They don't get any activity. It allows the bacteria to build up in the lungs, and, you know, that relates to respiratory, which is the most common illness in chondros. So I think that captive chondros would be a lot healthier if they were given environments where they could move around more and be more active and be able to respire better in order to keep that bacteria load low in the lungs. So I don't think it's a matter of, you know, a certain temperature or a humidity level. I just think it's inactivity, you know. And the majority of people that get chondros, they start feeding the crap out of them. So, you know, they're obese. They're tucked in a perch, and they have low inactivity. Well, that's the majority of America, and look, we're all unhealthy. So snakes are no different.
You know, it's funny that you say that, because I heard the same thing. Actually, I think it was Scott Stahl that was talking about it one time when he was talking about respiratory infections and the Burmese pythons, because most keepers aren't keeping these pythons in Burmese pythons in cages that are big enough for them to move around. So, like, you know, they're a big snake, and their lungs just kind of, they're not really, getting the air that they need. And just like you just said, the bacteria builds up, and boom, respiratory infection.
Well, there's so much, you know, hydration that the respiratory tract controls, you know, breathing in, breathing out. So, you know, you talk about hydration and everything, the fact that these snakes are just sitting there and they don't move around, which allows a lot of that moisture and to build up in the lungs, which is a perfect environment for bacteria, and, you know, it just makes sense. So I have a fairly nice-sized collection, but I'm in the habit now that when I spray down, clean, or do anything, I pull every snake off the perch and just make it crawl around, move around, put it back in the cage, and move on to the next one. And in the past, I've had rain chambers where I've put the snakes in the rain chambers. They're usually much taller, bigger cages, and just left them in there, and they just move. They defecate to get all that crap out of them, which also can lead to toxins, which will lead to illness. And that's another one of my sort of thoughts on chondros. You know, again, they're draped in this coil. People are overfeeding them, and I'm guilty of it from the past, but I've learned, you know, it's, you know, they're packed full of feces and urates, and that's just the toxic environment sitting into their intestines. You know, they're just packed full of this waste material that the body's still filtering through, you know, so the kidneys are getting hit hard. It's just a toxic environment. So feeding them less, making them move more, and providing fresh air is going to lead you with a healthier collection.
Awesome. So when it comes to breeding your chondros, what's your approach to getting them in the mood, I guess?
Yeah, pretty simple. I reduced the light cycle down to 8 hours, and I have a temperature drop where, you know, my typical daytime high is 84 degrees, and I just bring it down to 80. And my nighttime is, I have no heat on any of my animals at night downstairs, so it can get down into the 60s, like between 65 and 69. So whatever it may be, however cold a winter we're having, is how cold the room will get. And that's just basically how I breed them and usually have some success.
Excellent. So, like, you've had pretty good success with your chondros breeding? I mean,
For many years I've been getting pretty good clutches of chondros. So the last couple of years I've chose not to breed just because of some lifestyle changes that I've had here at home. But this year was I'm getting back on my feet to breed some clutches, and we have some good projects going on right now.
Have the babies been hard to start, or is it like a...
Well, I think that really depends on the... We'll group it into two different ways, locality or bloodline. You know, there's just some localities of chondros that are just so hardy and just take off and feed, such as, you know, Biox and things. But, you know, my Kofi Owls have been really difficult starters. You know, I've worked with some other bloodlines that are out there that have been difficult starters. And, you know, again, there's clutch variability. You know, you'll have, whatever, 15 babies and 10 of them take off like crazy, but 5 of them are pain in the butt. So there's just a lot of variation with chondros. So you spend a lot of time, you know, tease feeding and offering them different prey items. You know, I use a lot of different scents. I use house gecko scents, you know, your basic tree frog, quail feathers. You know, I try everything to try to get a baby started without force feeding it.
I got a quick question to hit on something that you talked about. This is probably for more of the beginners that are getting into chondros. When you're taking the chondro off the perch, any tips that you could give somebody for taking them off?
Yeah, you know, it's basically, because of arboreal snakes, their tail is their hand. And as long as their tail is secure, the snake will feel more secure. So, you know, but their tail is also their trigger, meaning it's their lure. So you basically, your approach would be start to pull them off from their head and mid-body and then get your hand back by their tail so they have something to wrap their tail around, and that, you know, that's going to give them their security. And it's really all about making them secure. So if they feel secure, they're going to be less flighty and less nervous and less scared. So your chances of them, you know, trying to defend themselves because they're scared will be less likely. So, but it's just a slow approach. I mean, if you raise chondros up from babies, they should be as tame as can be. I mean, if you came to my house, there's very few chondros you can't just reach in and pull off the perch without a problem.
Cool.
So,
all right.
I've heard that if you pull a chondro off a perch with a little bit too much force, you could actually injure their spine or tail severely.
I'm sure that's definitely a possibility, but if you're pulling that hard, you shouldn't be keeping snakes anyway.
Good point.
Good point.
That is a very good point, and I will say that next time I hear that. So,
it's again, you know, people, you know, there's a lot of people that keep animals that aren't animal people, and that's sort of frustrating. And
that's the truth.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, you have to learn to read your animals. You have to. My biggest thing is, and you guys all know because you're snake guys too, is the fact that we spend our lives trying to explain to people that these aren't these aggressive beasts they've been made out to. And so I've come up with this new analogy because I was at a party, and there was this big musclehead guy there, you know, this big manly man. And, you know, he's talking about these snakes that he was killing in his barn and everything. And, of course, you know, I'm just sitting there shaking my head. You know, so I said to him, I was like, you know, I said, I'm going to give it to you. I said, the only way I think that you'll be able to understand it. I said, if I cut off your arms and legs and throw you on the ground, I was like, what do you have left to defend yourself with? And he was just like, my mouth. And I was like, and are you scared because you can't get away? And he was just like, yeah. I was like, so snakes aren't aggressive and mean. They're actually scared. I was just like, and you have to realize that they're trying to get away from you. They don't want to be near you, you know. So I'm basically explaining to them. So, you know, our whole lives we're trying to defend the things that we love, which are snakes. And that's the problem with people. They really don't know how to read the animals. And, you know, I've been in a lot of people's homes that have snake collections, and just to see them handle them, you know, they're afraid. They shouldn't even be handling the animals just because they're so afraid. You know, they're reading the snake as being aggressive when the snake is actually scared. So if you learn that it's actually fear and you approach them differently, that they respond so much differently. And
right.
You know, give them that security. And like I said, if there's a chondro on a perch and it's clasping the perch really hard, it's because it's scared. It doesn't want to be pulled off that perch. You know, that's its security. So you have to reinforce it by saying, look, you know, it's okay. You know, just put your hand underneath there and slowly just start to manipulate it to let it crawl into your hand, and don't rip it off the perch.
Right.
Yeah, don't do that.
Right. You know, and then you start dealing with other animals that really have a hand, as I call it, like scrubs. And even my bull and I mean, they can wrap your hands tight enough that, you know, you start to feel the circulation come off on them. I mean, they really have a stronghold. So they're the animals you always want to make sure are secure.
Yeah, I definitely understand that one. Yeah. Our barn ex can, like, I think I was losing feeling to my hand when one of ours was just coiled. She wasn't aggressive or anything. She was just hanging out, but she gripped on so freaking tight. It was ridiculous. But anyways, Mark, what projects are you working on with your chondros right now? Do you have any specific bloodlines, projects,
Sure. Wacky
things coming out?
You know, locality-wise, I'm really trying to produce more Kofi owls just because, you know, in the beginning, there was just a handful of us that got them when they first came in, you know, throughout 2003 and 5, and a lot of that founder population has died off just because it was wild caught and has reproduced a few times, and it's just not a locality that has a lot of representation out there, and it's such a unique locality, so I'm putting a lot of time and effort this year into trying to secure some more numbers in my collection with those guys. And just trying to work with other people I know that have them in the chondro community. So that's the one locality that I'm really working on. And then, you know, I've been working with a lot of the Calico and Dream bloodlines just because they've obviously have produced some of the nice color morphs, and they continue to produce, you know, just chondros that I never dreamt were possible. You know, you're starting to see colors like oranges and yellows and reds and blues and blacks and, you know, just a whole multitude of colors. So we're, like I said, we're sort of in the infancy of the potential of the green tree python world. And as more people get their hands on these designers and keep outcrossing them, I just think it's going to just lead to some really extreme, crazy animals. And, you know, there's a pretty good population of animals that are showing the potential right now. So really like the calico stuff, and not just the melanistic stuff. And we have high yellow, you know, like I said, my cornerstone animal is Bruise, which is a dream calico animal. So I have a pretty big group of calico dream stuff that I'm working with. And then I've done some outcrosses with Kofi Alice to Biox that really produce high yellow and high white and sort of like tricolor looking animals, which I think are beautiful.
Cool.
So
the intermixing of localities with chondros not as big with the intermixing? Like right now we have over at the second place we have the Wamina scrubs, and we have Jaipiras and things like that, and sarongs and a few other things. Pretty sure that the scrub community would take my head off if I bred our Wamina to one of our sarongs for some reason. So,
well, I mean, I totally agree with that, honestly, and not to be a hypocrite, but the reason why is, you know, scrubs in general, they need to have that foundation of captives here, you know, produced. So, I mean, to emphasize the locality stuff, I truly believe, but, you know, you get on Kingsnake and there's so many farm hatch chondros. I mean, we're talking thousands. I've been to these farms and there are thousands and thousands and thousands of chondros. So, you know, we've kind of gotten past the point where, you know, hey, they're being bred, they're being outcrossed, and that's on its way. But not to sound like a hypocrite, but I truly believe with the scrub community that, yeah, the locality pure stuff is so important right now.
Gotcha. Okay. So I understand what you're getting at.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I'm sure there's a lot of potential to produce some crazy scrubs, but let's get some F1, F2, you know.
I totally agree.
They're hard enough to breed, you know. They're in the scrub complex, and, you know, the that part of Morelia is, for whatever reason, you know, the whole scrub complex they're difficult species to breed, and they just don't breed like all the other types of snake species that we're used to seeing. Until we figure out why, you know.
No idea. I mean, we just paired our Wamina. We have a patternless Wamina. We just paired her up with a boy. And I'm like, are they big enough to breed yet? Are they big enough to breed yet? And, like, my business partner, Chris, is like, it's been a week, dude. Knock it off, okay? Just give it some time. I'm like, so, yeah, I'm excited for them. But
the one thing I can tell you, is when I think a lot of people go wrong is people think snakes have to be a certain size to reproduce. And you got to remember, everything is about species survival. So you would be surprised how small some animals are that reproduce. You know, like it took me a while to realize, you know, just that, you know, you don't have to get a snake up to 6-7 feet for it to be reproductive size, you know. So
gotcha.
You know, don't worry if it's big enough, you know, if it's established and, you know, 2-3 years old, it chances are it's big enough to breed.
So, sweet.
You know, the female that reproduced was tiny for me in comparison to some of my other Bolani, you know. So you're talking a 9-pound animal that was, you know, just barely 8 feet. So.
Gotcha. So
yep. We
still got a few years, though.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Okay. So, actually, I've been wanting to ask you this question a long time, but with all your trips to New Guinea, we've always talked about your Bolans, you know, what you've observed with them, but what have you been able to observe with the chondros in the wild?
Well, we've been in a lot of different habitats of chondros, and really, I mean, I've never made any significant observations other than finding them hunting at night. And it's just, you know, basically hiking up trails or along, you know, stream beds and stuff like that, and finding them perched on trees and you know, in a basic hunting position with their head draped down in a coil. But I've never observed any of them eating anything in the wild. All the ones that I've handled have never regurged any prey. So I really don't have any significant observations other than being lucky enough to actually find them in the wild. And that, again, was another one of my most satisfying experiences in New Guinea, was to not only find bullseye, but to find chondros. So, you know, again, I guess the one observation that I mentioned earlier was in the Star Mountains. You know, in the Star Mountains, we were able to find chondros, scrubs, and bullseye all within about a three-hour trek. So, you know, to find three different species of Moralia, and then also to have the habitat be sort of extreme, meaning it gets fairly cold at night, that was a pretty interesting observation.
Huh.
So, but other than that, you know, I wish I could relate some stories of seeing them eat some prey or something like that, but unfortunately I don't have any good stories like that.
Okay. Have you noticed a difference in the localities? Like, because isn't it, I don't know if this is on record yet, but isn't there different species of chondros? There's three of them, right?
Right. You know, then it's being worked on. But, I mean, I think that that's, again, personal observation. Even with the animals we have in captivity, you see, you know, phenotypically, you know, different head shapes, different head sizes, different body types, you know, even different, like, you know, my Kofi owls are tiny. My adults are, I've had some bigger ones, but the majority of my F1s, they haven't reached much past between 600 and 800 grams, and I just can't get them any bigger, and I've tried. So I think a lot of it has to do with environmental pressures and basically where they evolved. So, you know, and as they do more genetic work and things like that with these new, you know, they're going to basically classify them as three different species. But, you know, I think for years us chondro heads have been observing these different head shapes and body types and scalation differences for years. So I think it's something we've been aware of for a long time. It's just taken the scientific or the taxonomist to finally say, look, you know, there's a significant difference here genetically and phenotypically, so we're going to split up the group.
Okay. I guess my last question when it comes to chondros, and I know you've hit on this somewhat already, is that you've heard the whole keeping Moralia at a constant temperature, not providing a hot spot. You know, do you have any other thoughts on that, why you think that's not a good idea?
Well, I mean, I don't know if it's, again, I mean, the biggest thing that I can say is I think it has to do with your own environment of how you're keeping them. I mean, it obviously works for Terry, and if other people have tried it and it works for them, that's great. But I think that's what makes us all unique keepers is, again, all of our homes or breeding facilities are different. We all have our own ideas. So you can extrapolate from that method and, you know, take something from it and apply it to your method. But that's what makes us all different. But I don't think it's the end-all, be-all method. And, you know, it's not the method I choose to use, but it doesn't mean that it's wrong. It just means that I know what works for me and my house and the success that I had. And as long as I don't have snakes dropping dead every week, I must not be doing something wrong. So I'm going to continue to do what works for me. And,
right.
You know, again, you know, I think there's so many other factors that play into captivity, and we've hit on them, you know, in the show already, you know, with inactivity and fresh water and lighting and air circulation. I mean, there's just so many factors that come into play here that, you know, a constant temperature is just one of those factors. So I think what people need to do is really, you know, look at their facility or how they're keeping their animals and watch and observe their animals and see what their animals are telling them. You know, are they spending too much time basking, and which, you know, obviously means they're not getting enough heat, or are they totally away from the heat all the time? And, you know, and with that, there's animal individuality. You know, I have animals that never, ever bask, and they're perfectly healthy and reproduce and do everything. But, you know, there's some of my chondros that never, ever go underneath the basking light. You know, where my bull and I are there, as soon as that light comes on, they're underneath that light like, oh, we've been waiting for this, you know. So, you know, it's, you know, just I think that people really just, again, you know, hear a successful method, you know, learn from it. Apply, you know, certain parts of it, you know, see what works for you. But I just don't think there's one method for keeping reptiles, just because everybody's facility is different and everybody's setups are different. So be an individual and just take from everybody and apply it to your method. And if your method is failing, keep trying methods until you succeed. But if it works for you, hey, more power to you.
Yeah. I'd have to agree with that one, because I don't think I could do that with my setup. So,
you know, and the thing is, I mean, if you think about it, you know, there's the majority of us keep our animals similar. We'll just say similar. You know, we know the basics. We know the temperature ranges. We know humidity ranges, things like that. And, you know, for someone like with that has Terry's experience to come out and say, hey, this is what works. It's new. It's fresh. You know, it stirs a buzz. And, again, take from it and apply it, and if it works, it works great. But if, you know, I know it's not for me, and it's not even possible in my house, like, you know, so even if it was the method, you know, I literally would have to basically start construction over and, you know, build something that would allow me to do that. And
it's, do that, right.
Not even possible.
No.
So.
Okay, we got a caller here. I'm going to click him on. He's got a question for you. Hold on 1 second. Hey, George, welcome to Morelia Python Radio. You got a question? Go ahead, shoot.
Yeah, hi, gentlemen. Listen, I just want to tell you, first off, I appreciate all your work you guys are doing. I've been to the Morelia Project probably for about 3 years now. Thanks for forever and a day, but Morelia specifically for the last 3 years. My question briefly is, with young juveniles or hatchlings, I've started to cool off my babies just as I do with my adults. And the reason I'm doing this is because in the wild, the babies don't actually get that little lift up to where they can get the extra food in that. And I also believe that in the long run, naturally, it prepares them for that dramatic change when they go through the cycling as breeders. And I was just wondering what your take was on it.
Yeah, I actually do the exact same thing, George. All my babies, like I expressed earlier, I have no nighttime heat on any of my animals at night.
Okay.
Yeah, once the heat clicks off, yeah, my babies are being temperature cycled just like my adults, and I agree with you. I just think it prepares them for temperature cycling, and it's more natural instead of, you know, the hatchling and young juvenile being a constant, whatever, 84 degrees, they get a temperature fluctuation. I think it's a healthy cycle for an animal to go through. So I think you're doing something that I think is correct. I mean, I've been doing it for years and haven't had any problems. The one thing I'll tell you is that the growth rate is a little slower. So, you know, I know people that I've seen their chondro babies being kept at a constant temperature, and they'll be the same age as mine and twice the size. So I do know that keeping them at a constant temperature will improve growth rate, but I personally believe that they should have that temperature cycle. So that's what I do.
All right, no, I appreciate that. Believe me, I have a ton of questions, but I don't want to be rude to the next guy. So God bless you. Keep up the good work, man.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you, buddy.
Thanks. Okay, all right.
Cool. Yeah.
We get callers now.
Yeah, whenever we talk about chondros, people just call in, man. It's just
something about the chondro.
Yeah.
I don't know why. I don't think we've ever had a chondro show where somebody hasn't called in.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, they're definitely, I mean, I can remember seeing the first picture as a kid, and I mean, I knew that I was someday somehow was going to keep one, and, you know, for it to come true. But, I mean, anybody that comes to my home that's not a snake person, when they see them, they just have no idea how beautiful they, you know, they can be. And then they start seeing all the different color morphs you're working with, and, you know, they're just like, oh, my Lord, you know, they had no idea.
Also, probably one of the other reasons Buddy wants me to just sell all my stuff and get a bunch of chondros. Anyway.
Well, you at least need one.
So, yeah, yeah. Well, see, the problem is that if I get one, I'm going to stare at it, and I'm going to be like, well, that's no good. It's only one. you know what, I'll get another one. And then I have two. And it's the whole thing that happened with carpet pythons that landed me into this mess anyway. So I see what you're getting at. But what I really want, and like if you listen to past episodes, this is all I freaking talk about, is the rough scales. Apparently you have some, Mark.
Yeah, they're definitely a unique Morelia.
So comparing all the cool Morelia that you already have in your collection, how do the rough scales compare to them?
Well, getting a little bit of static. Can you guys hear that?
Yeah.
A little bit, yeah.
All right, cool. You know, I am definitely fascinated with them. And, you know, in my own experience, in the 90s, I kept a large collection of annulated boas, which aren't your typical arboreal species. You know, they like to wedge in things, and they're sort of slow and deliberate and passive. And when I got the rough scales and started keeping them, they fill the exact same niche as annulated. I mean, they're unique animals. They like to wedge themselves in things. You know, they'll perch. They're very slow and deliberate. They're curious. I mean, they're unique, and I feel very fortunate that I've had a chance in my life to own a pair and work with them. So I'm really enjoying them. They're probably the number one snake that I go to handle right now. So, like, when I want to hold a snake and watch TV and play with something, they're usually my go-to snake. And, you know, I'm really enjoying them, and they're just so unique. And my fascination is the fact that they're so closely related to chondros. And I know I'm only basing that off of phenotypic traits, you know, appearances and stuff, but I'll pull out a chondro and I'll pull out a rough scale. So I have a chondro in one hand and a chondro and a rough scale in the other, and I'm looking at the two, and, you know, the head shape's the same and the eye is similar, but, you know, when you're looking at the body and how they're acting, they're just so different, and it's, you know, it's just sort of a weird comparison. But now that I've had them, and, you know, going to Australia last year and going to the reptile park and talking to John and just, you know, seeing the presentation of the Kimberley where they're located, I mean, I would just kill to get into that habitat, and not just to find one. It's just so beautiful and unique and just to experience it. So I think they're cool critters, and I'm glad they're becoming more popular, and the fact that more people will get to experience them, and I definitely would recommend them just from the fact that they're different than, you know, I've worked with every type of, you know, carpets and jungles and everything else, and they are a unique species as far as their behavior and how they act.
Awesome. I definitely want some.
And they're easy, like, you know, I mean, I'm sure other people, you know, people have had more experience than I've had with them, like Terry and Cameron and those guys, but they're they're extremely easy compared to chondros and other things. They're not a difficult species, so it makes that, you know, makes keeping them that much easier and that much more pleasurable. And you know, they can house large food items and, you know, not have any issues, and just, you know, they're just not a species you have to worry about. It's just make sure they're clean and the temperatures are right, and they're good to go.
Cool. I am very much looking forward to that.
Just on a side note, you got any ideas on why their scales are keeled? Any thoughts?
No, the only thing I can think of really has to do with something with the habitat and the rocks. But, you know, I've bounced this idea back and forth in my head, because then you look at the other extreme, you know, Bull and I feel like velvet, and they're from an area that has some of the most abrasive rocks I've ever seen. So, you know, why did they evolve? Why did Bull and I evolve with this smooth, silky skin, and then rough scales evolve with this keel? And, you know, is it because, are they trying to mimic a venomous snake that's there? Is it because of the rough habitat? You know, I've definitely bounced the ideas around, but, you know, with no conclusion, just sort of all speculation, as most people have.
Right. Yeah, right. I was just curious on your thoughts, because I know that's a unique feature about them, you know.
Yeah. Well, so, the way, you know, like, I've provided them with different things. Like, as soon as I've seen their sort of, I'm only relating this to annulated boas, but I used to use cork bark with my annulated boas, and the annulates would get in the cork bark and just wedge themselves up in there on like a ball. Like, they'd actually like press their sides against it, and there's no way you could get them out. So I started playing around with my roughies that way, and they do the exact same thing. They'll get in there and they'll just wedge themselves. So, you know, I wonder if the keeled scales allow them to, you know, wedge into rock crevices, and it's sort of an aid to, you know, where predators can't pull them out, or they just feel secure because they're locked against the walls. I'm not sure, but they do a similar habit that way. So I've been pretty fascinated with it.
That's cool. That's definitely very cool. I would
awesome.
Love kill for that. So, yeah, I want some.
Okay. Well, Mark, I don't know if there's anything else you want to hit on. I know let's talk up the symposium again. Throw the website out there again.
Yeah, absolutely. So, symposium, it's August 2nd through the 4th here in Timonium, Maryland, which is just north of Baltimore City, about 30 minutes. And the website is arboreal symposium.com. Pretty simple, arboreal symposium.com. Or you can find us on Facebook at the International Collective Arboreal Symposium. And, you know, cool. With all of us out there, I'm sure there's plenty of links and ways people can find it. And just encourage everyone to join us. I mean, just as a group, as a collective group, and for entertainment value, it's just so nice to actually meet people in person and put faces and names together and, you know, just talk shop. You know, there's these little pockets of people everywhere, and just to get everyone together. And, you know, we were talking about scrubs earlier, so I'm hoping that, you know, there's people that I'm hoping you guys will bring some scrubs. I would like to see cool scrubs.
We're going to bring some.
Yeah.
We're going to bring some. I know we're going to bring some Barnex and
Maroc's,
a few other things.
Well, let's talk about this real quick, because I've seen this picture floating around on Facebook, and it always has Tom Crutchfield's name attached to it. Have you seen
that? That new species?
Yeah. You guys know anything about that?
I'd have to get Chris on. He said something, because I asked him about it, because it was we were kind of like jumping around, like, do we call Tom Crutchfield and be like, yo, what is this? He said it resembled one type of scrub, the begins with an O.
Oxbill? Yeah.
There we go. Yeah.
I personally have been the oxbill. That's in the Star Mountains. And I've seen scrubs. I've seen them like that, but they have a lot more orange, and I'm sure that's just a variation of it. It's definitely possible, but
it could be a new locale.
I heard a rumor, and you know how rumors fly around, but I heard it was like an insular species off of an island, and it was a smaller species. In the pictures I've seen, the one, it definitely looked small, but, you know, seeing something like that, that's intriguing. Like, you know, I would love to see more of something like that.
That would be something I would be interested in seeing as well. I, for one, am looking to expand the wet lip in the United States. I mean, that would be, I think, fun to have those species kind of expand a little bit more.
Absolutely.
We'll get those red ones, whatever the hell they are. So maybe we'll bring a black to the symposium. They're arboreal. They climb good enough. So.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, like, there's so many species of snake that climb. I mean, there's obviously fossorial and terrestrial-only snakes, and you can usually tell by their body type, but I'm sure even some of those. Like, I'd like to see a picture of a blood up in a tree. That would be pretty funny.
I could put it up there, and people can be wondering what the hell.
Right.
Actually, at the zoo I used to work for, we had it was an emerald tree boa cage. It was a clear plastic, like, acrylic cell with two branches, and you're supposed to fill up the base with water. Yeah, I don't know why the hell you would put an animal in it, because it looked like it was just pretty much this box that would contain heat and tons of water and grow mold and bacteria. But we had a ball python, and his cage, the heating in his cage broke. So we took one of these arboreal cells, threw a bunch of stuff in the bottom, and I'm like, all right, well, he'll just hang out in here until we get his cage fixed. Next day I come in, the sucker's up in the tree, like on one of the perches. And I'm like, whoa, whoa, whoa. You're not supposed to be up there. So there's some pictures floating around of this ball python perched like a chondro. He's sitting kind of draped like that, not fully because he was, you know, he didn't have the body for it, but
he kind of was sitting up there like that, and I thought it was hilarious. So.
Heck yeah. So, yeah, like I said, I'm hoping that we can get some really cool stuff like that. Well, I tell you, being on this show must have helped, because I just got on the registration, and there's 4 new people that registered while we were doing the show, so that's a plus.
There you go. Nice.
The Morelia Python radio bump. We finally have something. So, awesome.
Well, yeah, Mark, thanks for coming on the show. And one more thing, what's your website? Your
yeah,
personal?
Pretty simple. It's just bolinspythons.com. And, you know, it's everything Bo and I. So.
Gotcha.
It's just the way it is.
That's fine. So.
And I'm hoping that there'll be more information as the year progresses. So if I've held off on, you know, putting something on there about my one success just because I think that a lot of it was luck. But if I can replicate it this year, I at least think I'm starting my own personal formula. So maybe that will help people apply it to their formula, and there'll be more people producing these things. So we'll see.
Awesome. Okay. Well, I really hope that works out.
If you figure it out, feel free to come back on and let us know how you did it. But I want to thank you for coming on, and you're welcome back anytime. And anything we can help you with, don't be afraid to ask. So.
All right. Thanks so much, guys. I look forward to seeing you guys this summer.
Yep.
Oh, yeah. Thanks a lot, Mark.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
All right. There we go. Another one. In the record books. There we go.
How many times have you said that after a show?
You know, I don't know. There's just certain episodes that, you know, I really feel like we talk about stuff that matters. You know what I mean?
Mostly the Condors and the Bull and I. Yeah, I mean, you know.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's why I like having Mark on, is because it's like the puzzle that is the Bull and I is, like, finally being solved in some way, point something. So maybe down the road, Bull and I will crop up in other places. They won't be like this mysterious thing that everybody's like, I have a bunch. They don't do anything, but so.
Yeah, I just think that there's cool. certain, I guess for lack of a better term, I'll call them snake nerds. You know what I mean? I don't know. I mean, you know,
it's a good term. It's a great term. It works
just really
for a lot of people.
Yeah, they're just really into the species that they work with, and their passion and their dedication. And
drink
it up. but yeah, and you know, Mark falls into to that category. So you know, it's just always an interesting conversation. So
very, and like you think, like he is so passionate about the species that he's actually gone and observed them in the wild. That like. We have to go to Australia now. So,
yeah, and you know, and his mindset is totally different than like you take somebody like Terry, and I just like getting those different points of view out there, and I think it just drills home that point of, you know, you can't follow somebody's method like it's a formula for baking a cake. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's about, you know, figuring
everybody
out.
Everybody has their own different methods. I mean, I love it that the fact is that you and I are not too far away from each other in our houses and have completely different methods, keeping kids completely different ways, and have completely different, like just ways of doing things, of raising, breeding, feeding, but all get the same exact result, eggs and success with the animals every year.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Of course, one of us has a clutch of 25 eggs on the ground, and the other one has
maybe 12. Well, see, again, that just goes back to the thing that I don't really want a clutch of 25 eggs.
Yes,
I don't.
Do. Yes, you do.
Nah.
Yes,
no,
you do.
Because
yeah.
Because here's the
thing.
They're
all albino zebra?
No. Listen, no? I got so many different pairings and things that I want to do. I would rather have 15 clutches of 10 eggs than.
See, but that's the thing is that you have
5 clutches of 50 eggs.
You have the ability. Whoa, now I have 1 clutch of 50 eggs. Anyway, you have the ability with all those other ones to have all those smaller clutches.
I don't really have, the space I have is somewhat limited. So having the bigger animals, to have the one clutch that is of a bigger size, the gate is basically adding up to, I could have had, you know, six animals that have the same kind, like four or five eggs that have the same size clutch. So I'm just getting them out of one animal.
Yeah, I guess it just goes back to my, what I'm trying to do as far as my whole business approach. Like when if I'm trying to promote the carpet python complex or Morelia in general, you know, I'm not going to be able to have, you know, one clutch of, you know, 50, or if I'm trying to do 15 pairings, I just don't have the time to
you pick them on Sophie, dude.
Well, I'm just saying, like, you know, I just don't have the time to do, like,
right,
a clutch that's that big. I just, I don't have the time nor the space. And I'd much rather have, you know, because I just don't want to have all crosses. I want to have some stuff that's pure, you know. I want to have
some
species, you know. I like the mix of everything. And that's just how I approach it. There's just, it's just different for me. But, you know, I guess if I had the time and the space, you know, I'm not going to say that I wouldn't want 50 eggs, I guess. I mean, I don't know. I just I have to do this full time because there's just no way, you know. I'd be able to juggle it all, so. More power to you.
Oh, look, thank you.
You know?
Thank you.
And you do, you're more into the show circuit, so you're, like, out there more, and
I hate the show circuit.
I really don't like it, man. I want
to
sell my
things. I wish to God I had more online sales so I didn't have to do the show circuit. I was talking to Chris today, and I'm like, when's the next show? He's like, I think usually there's one in, like, Oaks. I'm like, like after the 3-day show, I'm like, I don't want to do it. When's a symposium? I want to do that.
Yeah, like,
can we just not do shows till the symposium? Unfortunately, no. So,
yeah, with me, like, I'm happy with doing 3 shows a year. I think I'm geared to go, like, as long as they keep going with the ICAS, that will be one show I do, and the other two will be Finley. And that would
good
be it.
This way you don't have to be competition for me at Hamburg. I'd hate to have to crush you.
Again, I don't think that my business model or what I'm trying to do,
no.
I don't think that I'm going to have success at Hamburg. You know what I mean?
No. Not like it will.
I to come in and buy an albino zebra at Hamburg. It's, you
well,
know.
No, that's the thing. Is most of the time, it's like you had the. That's the thing. Is I'm out of all my, like, 50, 60, 70, even $100 sibs, stripes, this, that, and the other thing. They're all gone. I have, like, 3. So the only thing I can think of that got left are tigers, jags, caramels. Those are the ones that kind of linger for a little bit, which you wouldn't expect. That's the thing is that people don't understand is that they think if I'm going to breed it, it'll be a market. So if I breed it, I won't have to worry about selling the morph. I'm going to have to worry about selling these stupid little non-morph little babies. In my opinion, and what I've found, the non-morphed normal ones that you price below $100, they go faster than the morph. They just go. I guess it's because most of the time at reptile shows, you have a serious buyer that knows what they're doing and wants the color, wants the morph, and they buy it and leave, you know, or you have the person that's looking for a pet, looking to get started. Like,
yeah.
I mean, my first carpet python was just a normal male carpet. Nothing special about him. And, of course, he was like, yeah, that's what got me interested, and that's what got me in love with the species, and that's what brought me to, you know, the tables of Jason Balin talking about jags and tigers and things like that. So.
Yeah, I think, like, to me, you know, I'm quite happy just going to the shows and being at your table, and, you know, to me, I would much rather bring, like, maybe, you know, a cool carpet and just have it there for people to come up and look at, and then you can sell your carpets.
That would be something very cool is if you were to give me, like, if you give me something new, some brand new morph to just display on the table, that would be awesome because I'd love to have people see the newest, because I'm always talking about, don't worry, the morphs are coming, because they're like, oh, there's, like, well, you know, this is cool, but I really would like an albino. I'm like, well, they're coming. They're here. It's just now they're being bred, and the price are going to go down. So they're here. These morphs that you all want with boa and retic and some of them with ball python, they're all in carpet python. It's just it's taken a bit. Plus, you're going to see morphs the likes of which you've never even thought of with, you know, the combinations of ghost granite or sun glow zebra. I mean, all those are coming. So to just kind of bypass it because it's brown and ugly in its normal form, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, but I think of even like, you know, I know you're talking about the morphs and, you know, I got the Frankensnake title attached to me. But, you know,
yeah.
Like I think of the inland carpet, for example.
Which is gorgeous.
You know, I got to tell you. I don't know. I've seen them at the Hamburg when Ben had them. But there's just something different when they're in your hands, man. I don't know if I'm just a carpet python freaking nutbag or what.
You are, because the thing, I almost fell over because there was that one Hamburg where I was running the show, and Jason Balin came like running across the room and said, "There's guys here with albinos, and they're trying to sell them." And the guy handed me a baby albino and let me hold it along with my first ever Darwin. Like, they're both Darwins, one visual albino, one het female, and I actually got to hold them, and I'm like, people are asking me questions about the snakes on my table, and I'm like, sure, right? Oh yeah, cool, this is so awesome, this is the greatest snake ever. So
right.
And I'm like, and I was about ready to be like, do you want to take all the animals on the table if you give me these two? So it was it was one of those things. And of course, like, Aurora was on the table. So I mean, it was a weird moment, but it was, you get it in your hands and it's something different. Like, first time I held my Brettles, I thought they were the coolest things ever. A little pissed at them right now, but that's because they won't breed. Anyway, it's just that you get the thing you thought about. Like, the first time I ever get to hold a rough scale, I fear for the person who's going to have to pry it away from me. It's going to be ridiculous. So I can't wait.
You know,
and also even Bolins and things like that. Holding the new scrub species and the white lips and all this other stuff. It's something cool when you get to hold it in your hand for the first time.
Yeah, and I think that if people see that, you know, I have these crazy visions of, you know, what my table is going to look like in the future when I do an expo, and I think about, you know, my display case where I have each of the subspecies of carpet pythons on display, so that, because it's one thing. Here's another thing that I've noticed, and me and Zach, when we were taking pictures, we're seeing it right in front of our eyes. The variability, it's one thing when you're looking at pictures, man, and you're just, you know, it's like, here's a picture of a jungle, and right underneath of it is a coastal, and it doesn't have the same visual effect. But when you got a jungle, and a brettle, and an inland, and a coastal, and, you know, an Irian Jaya, all right in your hands, you can see the complexity of what the carpet python world is about, you know, and it's just wild. And if I can get people to experience that, you know, hey man, that's kind of what I'm aiming to go, because I think that's what's going to be. And I'm not even talking morphs. I'm just talking the straight up subspecies. You know, I can't even imagine what it's going to be like when I have a diamond finally to round out the whole thing. You know, but you know,
you're not done yet. You got Imbricata, you got Owen Pelly. That's right.
Yeah, they're not.
I said Owen Pelly. Well, if we're going to do it, you better do it right.
Yeah, and you know, I was cleaning today, and I'm on vacation, so I kind of have a more laid back approach to where I actually get to, actually spend time with my snakes and really get it. See what's going on, and I'm opening up my cages to the Moluccan scrubs, and I'm like, man, these are just beautiful animals. Oh my god!
Oh yes,
beautiful.
You should see our F2 Gen boy. He's ridiculous. Just the color off of him is insane, and I'm like, you were the second. His parents were producing captivity, and then he was producing captivity, and we got him. And it's like, you were like the key, in my opinion. You were going to do everything right. And he's just so pretty. Anyway, so.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't know. It's just, it's cool. And I'm just in there and I'm spending time with the snakes. And the albino just shed. You know, I'm looking at it and I'm like, oh my God, man, this is just insane. I can't believe that I actually have an albino carpet in my room. You know, I don't know. It just blows my mind. I just, you know, it's cool when you can actually sit back and the biocondro. I'm telling you, man, if you came to my place and you walked into the room and you saw this thing, you know, your head's going to be like, what? My wife does it all the time. She walks in, you know, I have all these high-end morphs and everything else, and she could give a shit less about any of them. The thing that she goes to every single time is the chondro. She's like, man, that thing is really pretty, you know, so.
Well, you had that picture of you. Was that the one you got at Carpet Fest?
Yes, yes.
So they have that picture of you, like, staring at it as, like, I'm trying to run the auction, and, like, you're not taking bids, just staring at the chondro. So I'm like, and then you started bidding, and I'm like, well, okay then, and then it was done.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, man.
So.
Speaking of Carpet Fest.
We should promote that.
Yeah, let's put the plug out there, because we're coming up on it. So it's,
I'm excited.
It's going to be a good time, and it's only really a month and a half away. So.
Holy crap.
Yeah, our good buddy, Howard Redding. Redding Reptile Breeders. He's the host, like he was last year for the 2012. This is 2013. It's on May 18th. It's in Waldorf, Maryland. If you want to contact us about anything as far as putting something up for the auction, again, I know it's still early. People don't have their clutches. They're just getting laid, whatever. Anything at all that you want to put up, feel free to contact us at info@moreliapythonradio.com. And we'll get that going. And all proceeds are going to Rico Walder. So it's a win-win, you know. There's going to be – I have a feeling that there's going to be some newer people, and that's a great thing because if you're just getting into carpets or even Morelia, because chondro breeders are there, because Maryland seems to be the hub as far as Morelia go.
I don't understand how that happened, but, yeah, you're right. It seems to be like the Holy Land.
Yeah.
So. Yeah.
I think I'm packing my bags and moving to Maryland. So I can't wait till
I'm going to stay here.
Till a ShopRite shows up. I'm down there, man. So, anyway, you know, it's going to be a good time. So if you can mark it off in your calendar, this is one of those events to attend. It's a cool, laid-back way to rub shoulders with some of the best breeders in the carpet python world, you know, on the East Coast at least. You know, so, you know, it's definitely it's a good time. So we want to thank Howard for sponsoring it again. Show him some love. Go over, like, his Facebook page, Redding Reptile Breeders. That's pretty much the way to get in touch with him. And not only does he make beautiful kitchens, he also makes beautiful snakes. So, show him some love. What else
Definitely.
Do I got? And also, at the same time, a month later, we have the Northwest Carpet Fest, and Heather is the one that's sponsoring that one. That's in Seattle, Washington, and that's on 6-8-2013. And if you want to get in contact with her, it's nwheather7, that's nwheather7@yahoo.com. And if you want any of that info, go over to www.carpetfest.com and check it out. You know who is coming to the ICAS? I'm looking forward to meeting Casper.
Really?
Yeah, he's coming over. He's going to make his rounds around the Morelia world, and you know, he wants to check out some of the stuff in the U.S. So I'm looking forward to meeting him. Hopefully he'll be able to go and check out some of the collections down there in Maryland and what's going on. So should be a good time.
Who else is coming?
Who's that?
Nick.
Oh yeah, I can't wait to meet Nick, man.
Yeah, and you've spoken to him enough on the phone. You figure you guys are meet, but finally,
I can't wait to finally put a face with the voice. You know, it's like I've talked to Nick for hours upon hours and. He sort of led me in a good direction in this whole hobby, and you know, it'll be good. I'm looking forward to hearing him talk too, man. The man knows his pythons, and you know, he's going to be giving a talk. I believe his talk's on Morelia and how the complex, you know, evolved. And you know, it's going to be definitely one of those talks that is a must listen to, at least for me and you fellow snake nerds out there. You know, Owen will be drunk at this time.
Not well. Hey, you and I are splitting the table, so I figure one day I will help you run the table.
What? Passion. That's all I'm gonna do.
Exactly. Exactly. If I'm sitting there and it's passion, 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 you know, find me underneath the table and, you know, it's fine. Prop me up and it's whatever. I figure we got a 3-day show. The first day, you and I will set up a table, we'll run the show, we'll be all nice and happy. The second day, you know, I'll start pulling hijinks and being myself. By the end of the second day, I'll start drinking, and then I won't stop until it's the end of the third day. So, because then I won't have to help you pack up. Just leave. So, yeah, it'll be fine. Come on. I bet you can get out and do it with me. It's okay.
Yeah. What else do I have? Let's see. I'm going to go down the list.
The list.
Events so we can jump off next week. I have a guest kind of in the works. I'm not really sure what's going on, so I don't want to announce it yet until I get confirmation. The week after that, Aaron from iHerp is going to be coming on. Hopefully we don't have another disaster and we'll be better prepared. So looking forward to talking to him. If you don't know what iHerp is, you go over, check out iHerp.com. It's basically one of those things where you can track your collection, and I know it's a Morelia wonderland over there. So yeah, a lot of the same people that are over on Morelia Python forums are over on iHerp. So
right,
I look at iHerp as kind of the mix between Morelia Python forums and Morelia Viridis forums, and it kind of like mixes the two worlds together. So that's that. So yeah, I was saying, check out MoreliaPythonForum.com. That's MoreliaPythons.com. Probably the best forum there is for carpet pythons in Morelia. Check out MoreliaPythonRadio.com. You can see, you can link up to the show, take you to the iTunes where you can subscribe, takes you to the Blog Talk Radio page where you can listen to past episodes. You know, definitely if you go over there, go over to the Blog Talk page and follow us. That way, if we do these special shows like on Thursday, you'll know that they're coming up. And
right,
we always try to sneak them in there every once in a while,
just to keep you all on your toes.
Yeah. Carpet Fest, we hit on that. Make sure you give some love to Howard Redding, Redding Reptile Breeders, over on Facebook. I put the link over on Morelia Python Radio Facebook page. Go over there, like that as well. Show us some love there. The ICAS, the website for that again is www.arboreal symposium.com. I think if you don't go, man, you're going to miss out on it. So definitely,
yeah.
Definitely something you want to. I know that people are saying the ticket's a little high and such, but it's going to be well worth it, man. I'm telling you.
For
it's going to be
a 3-day show, it's, yeah.
You know, I was
it's
thinking about that.
Worth it.
I was thinking about it. It's like, what's Hamburg for a table? 160 bucks?
For a table?
Yeah.
Table, $75 for a table.
And that's for one day?
It's for one day.
Well, I don't know, man.
But see, I did a three-day show at Reading. And that was $175 because I had to pay for electricity.
Well, this isn't far off. It's how much more fun we're going to have.
Exactly. So it's a little bit more, but it's going to be 10 times more fun.
Yes.
Because, you know, unlike at Reading, where if I'm having a bad day, shit. This, if I'm having a bad day, I'm going to have some crab cakes, have some ribs.
Right.
Frank's going to throw stuff at Jason Balin, so it's okay.
No.
So. Yeah,
and let's see. But, so yeah, check out that. Go over there, sign up. You know, definitely want to must-attend event. And check out Mark's page again, BolinsPythons.com. If you want to get into Bolins, there's a wealth of information over there that he has, and you can check that out there. I think the only thing I have left is ebmorelia.com. Go over there. I'm redoing the site now that I have a professional photographer helping me out. So.
Oh my God.
give Zach Baez a little shout out. Go ahead, Owen. It's all yours. Take it out.
Thank you. All right. So what we have for Rogue Reptiles is you can catch us at the shows coming up this month. We have the April 20th show at Oaks, PA, in the Reading at the Oaks Reptile Show. Then we have the April 27th Hamburg Reptile Show. And that's it for April so far. Also, check out rogue-reptiles.com for the babies that we're going to have for sale, as well as bios and pics of all the parents that are kind of breeding this season. You can also go over to Facebook and like us on Facebook at Rogue Reptiles on Facebook. That will be your best source to get all the latest news at Rogue, all the clutches as they hit the ground, as well as all the babies when they start pipping. If you see any babies that you are interested in, please do not hesitate to contact us if you put on some of our waiting lists. Some of our waiting lists are filling up when it comes to certain morphs. The Super Caramel list is already pretty long at this point. So if you were contemplating getting on that list, I would send me an email and get on that now. So far, I think that's all I got for us. So what we'll say is thank you very much for listening. We hope to catch you guys all next week for some more Morelia Python Radio.